Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Riff.
And today we have with us a special guest, Michelle Jewell. We're very grateful to have you here. We were put in contact with you through another contact in North Carolina, so this is a very lucky meeting for us. Michelle works at the Southeast Climate Adaption Science Center, where she does science communication, and that's through NC State. You've also done a lot of research on sharks. So we're excited to talk about both things, sharks and science communication. So thank you so much for coming here today, Michelle.
Shahir, Maggie, I am thrilled to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Of course. You've also appeared on the Discovery Channel for Shark Week, which I think most people would be familiar with. So that's super cool. I haven't seen a Shark Week thing in a very long time.
A long time.
So I'm going to have to go check those out. Yeah. But I'm sure our audience is familiar. So that's a pretty cool gig to get to do. And I want to hear about that. For sure. But the first thing we always ask our guests is not really science related or science communication related, but is there anything that you have been reading, watching, listening to lately that you'd like to share that you think is cool or fun? Doesn't have to be science related at all.
It does not have to be science related at all.
No.
You know, I don't know if it's because of the times we're currently living in, but I have been binging The Diplomat on Netflix.
Oh, okay.
Solid show. Highly okay. recommend. I love a really good complicated storyline with lots of characters and
okay.
the politics are complicated. Yeah. If you're looking for a binge, that's a good one.
Okay. That's perfect. I have not seen it, but I have heard of it. And yeah, a good complicated, detail-oriented political show is always a nice... I don't know if it'd be a nice escape, but maybe in some way from our what's currently going on. Awesome. Yeah, we just like to hear what scientists are doing outside of their science work. And we've gotten a lot of great recommendations and kind of showcasing that as scientists, we also can partake in non-nerdy things sometimes. So,
or different nerdy things.
Different nerdy things, yeah. A lot of scientists read a lot of science fiction. So we've got a lot of science fiction recommendations as well. So great. We'll add that to our list of recommendations for our listeners.
Are you a science fiction nerd or a science fiction fan?
You know, I wouldn't say I'm a nerd. Certainly not. I feel like that's the final boss of nerd levels once you get into science fiction. And I do not compete at all on that spectrum. But I do dabble. I think my last science-y fiction thing I read was Orbital, which was really, really good.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I love to, just dabble into it. But I would certainly not label myself as a bona fide nerd in that space.
Yeah, me neither. Sometimes I want something very separate from actual science stuff. I'm not really reality TV, but I love documentaries and kind of trash YouTube kind of stuff that's a little bit completely unrelated.
A travel YouTube channel?
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I love fashion YouTube channels or like historical fashion and costuming, and it's very outside of what I do. And people are like, well, don't you just love science all of the time? And yes, and also no. So
yes and.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So, okay, very cool. All right, now we'll get into some of the more actual science stuff because that's what we're here for, Rust Belt Science. And you are also a fellow Rust Belter because you grew up in Michigan, correct? Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, I grew up outside of Flint, Michigan. I'm a daughter of General Motors. The second person in my family to go to college, so consider myself still first generation. Mm-hmm. My older sister was the first to go. Grew up, you know, on the picket line, et cetera, dealing with the kind of really interesting community of living in a General Motors town. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that grit I've taken with me throughout my career, and I think has made me kind of stronger, out-of-the-box thinker, especially when it comes to interdisciplinary fields or really challenging field problems in shark research, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, South Bend is kind of a car town in a lot of ways, right? We've got Studebaker here, so a lot of similarities between us and Flint. And I do find scientists from the Rust Belt area, from the Midwest, they do have something a little different than people who are traditionally, you know, grew up around academic settings. You don't really get to do that in the Midwest, even if you are from an educated family. I'm also a first-gen college graduate, so that's just not the culture here. And so we bring a lot, I think, to these academic spaces that I think I would like to talk even about science communication, how we engage with the communities that we grew up in that way. So, yeah, we're very excited to have Russ Belter's on the podcast. It's pretty common. And Shahir, you didn't grow up here necessarily, but you've lived here for a very long time.
I'm a transplant.
Yeah. So
I'm a transplant.
I'll share some of the same things. So there's not really sharks in Michigan. So how did you become interested in sharks and marine biology? And I know you're kind of more broadly interested in zoology and animal behavior, but you work primarily with sharks. And how did that happen? Is that something that was always interesting, or did you kind of come upon that in your academic journey?
Both. Mm-hmm. So I was certainly a child of cable TV. I remember when we got cable and it was, you know, the Discovery Channel. You know, the friends who had the higher cable subscription had National Geographic Channel.
Yeah, that was like next level. Yeah.
Right? Like there was the Nintendo and then there was watching Discovery. And so I honestly grew up with Shark Week. I'm as old as Shark Week. It started the same year I was born. And so I watched a lot of these shows and kind of viewed it as like this fictitious world, right? Of these researchers out on these boats and just completely separate from my life. I didn't even consider that those were humans. Mm-hmm. Like those were actual adults doing this for their job. And that started there. And then when I went to Michigan State University, I did my degree in zoology. It took me a while to land on zoology. I think that's also a first generation thing. Mm-hmm. We just kind of get dumped into college and it's like, I don't know, get a degree, like figure it out. And so I started off as an environmental engineer, was doing okay with that, but I hated the classes, had a music background too. So I was dabbling in that, but didn't like auditioning and found that to be really high stress and was not that passionate enough about it. And so when I was exploring around, I was looking at, you know, fisheries and wildlife classes, and then ultimately ended up in zoology. It just kind of stuck with me in a way that the fisheries and wildlife classes didn't for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So it was my senior year of my zoology degree. I needed to take a few independent study credits. I'd met a professor who had been working on geology. Dr. Michael Gottfried is his name at Michigan State. And I went to his office and I said, look, I'd really love to work together on an independent study. And, you know, do you have some ideas? And he said, oh, well, I've got all these shark heads that I need somebody to dissect. And I said, sign me up. That's awesome. So that kicked off a whole load of things. I went up to the top floor of the Michigan State University Museum every week and had in particular this really large great white shark head. It was from a 3 meter, you know, 12-ish foot, 9 to 10 foot great white shark.
Big boy.
Huge. Yeah. And so like it was heavy, like I had to, you know, lift it out of the formaldehyde every time and like get it into the hood and... You know, was taking all the flesh off of it because, again, it's going to sound like this was 100 years ago, but this was way before 3D imaging. We were trying to do CT scans of all of these different skulls as part of Dr. Gottfried's research. So a thing to be useful towards that process was to scrape as much of the tissue off of the cartilage, which was super soft. You know, it's the same stuff that's in the tip of our nose and our ears. So when you're dissecting, it's super easy to accidentally slice through some cartilage. You have to be really, really careful. So I was working on that. I was getting towards the end of my year, and Dr. Gottfried was like, well, what are you going to do next? And I was like, I don't know. I've got this degree. I'm going to be a millionaire, right? Like, that's how this whole college thing's supposed to work.
Right.
And he said, well, you know, if you enjoy this, and I had talked to him about my interest in studying predators and predator ecology, he said, well, you should try South Africa. That's a place I've been, and I think that you would really enjoy it there, and there's really good labs there that are looking at predator ecology. So I looked around, found an internship. I sold my Volkswagen Beetle for the plane ticket to get out there. I had planned to be there for 3 weeks, and I ended up staying for about 4 years, and I did not leave because I loved it that much. Mm. Yeah. So it's easy to look backwards and say, oh, you know, of course I was always going to end up in this situation. But let me tell you, at no point in my path did I have any idea what was going to come next, and just kind of made the best out of the opportunities that were out there. And I always encourage students to try and do the same if they're able to and are privileged enough to do that. Because, yeah, you just really don't know how those dots are going to connect in your career.
Yeah, I think I can absolutely relate to that. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was like learning, and then just kind of kept saying yes to opportunities that came up that seemed interesting. And this is not at all where I thought I'd be when I started. And it's scary to just kind of say yes and not have a plan. I think a lot of students now like want a plan for what they should do. But yeah, you just say yes, and the right thing kind of happens. And yeah, there's some luck and privilege involved too, but. And there's a lot of joy in just letting these interesting things take you on a journey. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great advice.
I think that's the Rust Belt thing too, honestly, yeah. Maggie. Like, it's just like, yeah, you know, you're just going to figure it out. You're going to work hard. Mm-hmm. You're going to, you know, I still am competitive, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just going to be the best at this thing. And like, I'm going to just try really hard. So I see a lot of that type of grit too, kind of translate through folks from the Midwest.
Right. And as a transplant, I can really witness and see this kind of Midwest work ethic that you just have to finish the job, and it doesn't matter what it is. You just got to do it. You said you're going to do it. You just do it. And yep. it's something that is part of the culture here that is just I've experienced, and now I'm trying to be that. Very difficult. So yeah. Something I admire very much.
Yeah, for sure. And that I think research takes a lot of that grit. And I'm very curious, right? My lab experience is microbiology, so very different. And thinking about you scraping tissue off of a shark head, I wonder if you could just kind of explain what that actually, like, a little bit more detail, because I think people don't know what scientists actually do in that kind of lab setting. You're kind of just doing some monotonous stuff, probably by yourself often, but you still obviously found joy in that. So can you just talk a little bit more about what that looked like?
Oh, yeah. And this was before podcasts.
Yeah.
So it's not like I had anything to listen to. Right. I literally would bring in a stereo and CDs. And like that was literally. So, yeah, it was hours and hours. I worked in the lab, you know, I said once a week. I was probably in there between 4 and 6 hours. Mm-hmm. It just kind of depended on when my hand would give out on me.
Yeah.
And it's important to remember, you know, sharks have an incredibly fascinating anatomy in the sense that their skin isn't really skin. Hmm. It's a shield of dermal denticles, and dermal meaning teeth. And that's exactly what they are. It's tons of tiny, tiny teeth that make up what we refer to as a skin, but it's not really true. And so it can cut you. And I have lots of scars from shark skin because if you go one way, kind of like a cat, if you go one way down it, it's smooth. Wow. And that's the aerodynamics of the shark, right? Them swimming through the water. If you go the opposite way, it will cut you like sandpaper, like 80 grit sandpaper.
Wow.
It's tough. So I would try in the beginning to work section by section. So try and get a patch of that armor off first. And then you would get into the tissue. And the tissue is super soft. Mm. So you go from having like almost like a, you know, hatchet at this thing trying to get through the skin. And then you have to be super careful and delicate with this tissue so that you don't accidentally slice through the cartilage that's underneath it. And in some spots, the cartilage is super thick. It's really robust. You don't have to worry too much about it. But for the really fine details, especially around the eye, especially around the nostril, it was super easy and possible to just accidentally slice through a thin layer of cartilage. So yeah, they are in kind of the opposite of mammals and humans. We're soft until you get to our bones.
Yeah.
They are like teeth, bone, and then they're super soft on the inside. Yeah. So it's a really different type of, yeah,
it's a
different type of
that.
Dissection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do they actually have bones like we do on the inside, like a skeleton? They're not considered bony fish, are they?
They're not bony fish.
Yeah.
So they are completely cartilaginous entirely. And their structure really is, you know, which won't surprise you, jaw, right? Like that's a ton of cartilage. Spine, which is a ton of cartilage. And then they have like essentially a pelvic girdle, which is kind of like a rib cage, but is not like a cage. It's just a bar that's floating kind of out of their anatomy towards their base.
Wow.
And that's it. Like, that is the skeletal structure of a shark. It's super, super basic.
And this is why the jaws are usually the ones that you find from, you know, million, right, multi-million-year-old sharks.
Right. Jaws, yeah, and teeth. Those, yeah, are the things that are the thickest cartilage. So they are the things that tend to fossilize the, yeah, best out, yes, of that whole skeletal structure. Yeah.
But they're not considered bones.
Nope.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, I did not know that, so I feel a little stupid.
No.
Well, you just assume, right?
Yeah.
Because you see the teeth and the jaws, and you just, oh, that's bone, right? Because it looks so ferocious, yeah, that it must be, but it's not. Wow.
Then they named a movie after a series of movies.
Yeah, right. And this is cool, too, and I'm going to geek out a little bit here because, you know, sharks existed before the metabolism of a lot of these things that you need in order to achieve a bone, yeah, right? So it's also just a evidence of just how old their lineage is, that their structure, the working blocks that they had in order to build a shark, evolutionary speaking, was cartilage. That was the toughest thing. It was before, like, calcium, you know, before we kind of figured out those harder structures, and then started, we as in living things,
yeah,
figured out the process of creating bone.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, my next question was going to be, what are some of the biggest misconceptions people still have about sharks? And I think we found one. I think unless you're a shark nerd or watch Shark Week, you might not know, have known that, but you know, what else about sharks do you think people really have a misconception about? They're, like we said, Jaws is really the only pop reference outside of Shark Week that people have, and I'm terrified of them, and I can imagine that shouldn't necessarily be the case based on what you know about sharks.
Yeah, and you know, I respect my shark colleagues who have done really great work on dispelling a lot of fear around sharks, and I think for the most part they're right. I think, though, that sometimes people can go too far to one side and say, you shouldn't be scared of sharks at all, which I don't think is true.
Yeah.
I think you should be as fearful of sharks as you are of bees, right? Like, that is the healthy line of respect, mm-hmm, understanding, like, what we have for bees. You know, don't mess with them. You know, if you find a hive, leave them alone. Like, that's a healthy level of fear. And I think that people should have that same healthy level with sharks, too, to better understand and prevent any sort of overlap, right, between, right, you and them, as you would them, you in a beehive, right, you know, that's really, really active. I think one of the misconceptions, that something I loved about working in the shark cage diving industry, was showing people just how intelligent sharks are. Just the way that they have really particular personalities. One shark is totally different from the other in how they respond to things. And I'm speaking mostly about white sharks, although this is true for bull sharks, tiger sharks, and others. But they have a really keen sense of intelligence and understanding their surroundings, and even taking advantage of some of their surroundings, too, in order to, you know, get prey or get food or whatever it might be. There's often misconception that sharks are kind of mindlessly, you know, I don't know, swimming around with their mouths open. I'm not quite sure what people think. They're not doing that at all. They're actually very selective in where they spend energy, the types of behaviors they perform, and whether or not they're going to interact with a thing or not. And I loved taking people cage diving because you can immediately see them sussing out a situation. Even coming up, you know, towards the cage and like looking straight at people as they swim by, kind of thing, like really acknowledging the environment that they're in, and not just like this, you know, black doll-eyed, mm-hmm, brainless, yeah, you know, thing, right, that you've, right, heard from Jaws, right?
And so that kind of takes us to the senses that sharks employ, the kind of to look around and see their environment. So obviously sharks can see, they have eyes just like us, but they also have some senses that we don't really have. They have a very strong sense of smell, right? So they can smell things that are very, very dilute in water, for example. But can they also feel electricity? Is that true?
Yes. They have two ways of doing it.
Two ways,
yeah. So there's the business end, the front end, uh-huh, right, towards the jaws, This is one of the best pub quiz answers you'll ever have. So listen up, listeners.
All right.
Ampelier of Lorenzini, one of the best structure names in zoology.
That's pretty cool.
Are these pores, right, that exist on their nose and around their, you know, back towards their eyes. They're little pores. When I was dissecting them, they were a pain in the butt because it was almost like trying to cut through a cheese grater because they are really, really cylindrical little tiny pores. And in those are filled with this gelatinous material, which is how they pick up electric senses towards their snout.
Okay.
And that's a really important sense because if you think about where their eyes are not like front and center like most predators are, like we think in zoology, like ours are. Our eyes are right in the front of our skulls. Mm-hmm. Shark's eyes are a little bit towards the back, almost like herbivores, like cows and horses mm-hmm. and things like mm-hmm. that. So when they're chasing something down at that last, you know, 5 feet of them going in for kind of a kill strike on it, they lose sight of it.
It's
so they
too close.
Need something yeah. else in yeah. order to like track down. And you mm-hmm. can see them, especially with hunting seals, that they are still very in tune with the fine turns of the seal right at the very end because mm-hmm. of that ampullae of Lorenzini that they have in their snouts. So that's one way that they do it. The second way they do it is a system called lateral line, which is a thin line that runs from their nose to their tails roughly.
Along the
in
side.
One spot, along the side. Yeah, okay. Almost like racing stripes, okay. right? But you can't really see them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the similar structure of this porous and gelatinous material. And there too, it's thought that they can pick up on kind of more, you know, almost like a sonar in a way. It's like a huge swath around them of some of the electric senses that are happening. Maybe that helps them pick up with hidden prey that they're passing by or other sorts of, you know, weaker signals that they're able to interpret. So, yeah, it's a fascinating adaptation that sharks and rays have.
Yeah.
But we're also finding that there are some other species that have really similar structures, especially like shorebirds and other birds that probe in the sand. They're finding that they too have electric senses in the tip of their bill. So it's not just sharks. There might be other species out there that have it.
Wow. That is really fascinating. And they essentially have like a halo around them, right?
Roughly, yeah.
To be able
exactly
to
right.
kind of figure out this environment, and they can sense the electrical signal of, you know, whoever it is, the living things have some sort of electrical signal that then they can, you know, figure out for the difference between that and like a rock or the sand.
Shahir, yeah. This is one of my favorite things to tell people when we go diving with sharks. The primary electric sense that we humans are producing all of the time is our heartbeat.
Yeah.
We're sending an electric signal in our body every time we tell our heart to beat. And other things, you know, moving around. So, yeah, when we go diving with sharks, they can detect our heartbeats with that lateral line system and that, you know, ampullae of Lorenzini that they have, too. Some people find comfort in that. Some people absolutely do not find comfort in that.
They can hear your heartbeat.
I don't know if I find comfort in that. I don't know. The ocean scares me in general a little bit, like just how vast it is, and there's these massive creatures. So the idea that they know I'm there is a little off-putting, but it is super cool that they have that ability to do that. I'm always fascinated by animals and even bacteria that have this ability to sense things that humans can't sense. It's quite remarkable how diverse everything is and how everything kind of interacts with each other in that way. So you clearly know a lot about sharks, but it seems like most of your research in your career has focused on the behavior aspects of sharks and it seems like predator-prey relationships. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of are there specific behaviors you're studying? Or are they centered around interacting with other things like that predator-prey? I think behavior is a super interesting way to talk about sharks outside of like their bones and teeth too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's two things that I find really fascinating about predator ecology just generally. The one is one of my favorite, you know, kind of subgroups of this field of study, which I think would be an awesome band name as well, is the ecology of fear. right? And ecology of fear is that predators can influence ecosystems merely by being present. Mm. They don't have to kill anything. And so that's an indirect way that predators have this huge influence over the structure of an ecosystem. And so when we think of a predator, we think of the two ways that they influence ecosystems. One is direct. They go in, they hunt things, you know, they reduce populations of their prey. That has a cascading effect. But the indirect effect of the ecology of fear is something that I find super, super fascinating. Mm. So, for example, in one of my lectures, I like to show the slide of, if you think of kind of a canonical watering hole in the Serengeti, right? Mm. You have giraffes at it, maybe some elephants are there, you know, drinking out of it. You've got some antelope, wildebeest, and birds and everything. And then on the next slide, I have a picture of a watering hole that's completely empty, totally empty. And that's because there are two lions sleeping nearby it.
Right.
And so that's a really dramatic impact, mm-hmm. right? That these prey animals are willing to sacrifice water because they don't want to run the risk of encountering this predator that they can see is there. And the kind of impact that that has, right? Maybe they've walked a really long time to get to that watering hole, but now this predator's rocked up, so they have to go somewhere else. And so we see this in marine ecosystems too, right? When white sharks are present in certain areas, they have this indirect cascading effect on all of their prey types and where they decide to go, specifically seals. Seals will make totally different habitat decisions when sharks are around versus when they're absent. And we see that cascade throughout the ecosystem too. So that's one side of predator-prey ecology I find really fascinating. The other side is that predators generally have, especially large predators, I'll say, large predators generally have these huge migration tracks. You know, they travel really long distances. And so they can carry impacts, say climate impacts, from one area thousands of miles separately to another area. Say they're having developmental issues in one spot, that can kind of translate to, again, this indirect ecology of fear to this new place that they go to. So in a really fascinating way, they can act as corridors, especially of climate change impacts, between these really disparate and separate places, just because they are this connective tissue between all of these different spots. And lastly, I'll say predators, thank goodness, they're big, so they're easy to tag. Yeah. And that makes it a lot easier to study than the small stuff, man. My poor friends who like try and tag really small birds, I'm like, I don't know how you do it. I'm throwing this like 3-pound thing onto a white shark. Like, good luck. Man, they're just a much easier animal to try and do any sort of telemetry with as well.
And I think most of us would think of the first example that you mentioned of, you know, predator reducing the population of a prey, but we never really think about this, you know, this ecology of a fear, as you mentioned, that when you're scared, you make different decisions. And I'm going to think about that for a while.
Yeah. I mean, Shahir, I can tell you, so one time, this was 3 years ago, in my garden, I saw a copperhead. It was eating cicadas. This was during the cicada, maybe it was 2 years ago. Yeah. It was during the big cicada thing that we had in the southeast. And anyway, this copperhead was on the spot near a fence, and I was fascinated by it, right? I'm a predator ecologist. I'm checking it out. But even today, when I was out clearing leaves, I avoid that spot at the fence because I saw a copperhead there one time 2 years ago. So, yeah, we are constantly influenced by an ecology of fear, even us as humans.
So you are the researcher, but also happen to be the subject of the research
as well. That's right.
How do you approach communicating about sharks and animals that are so often misunderstood and feared? You know, obviously you have a huge science communication role. In addition to just communicating the science, you are kind of overcoming an additional hurdle with so much misconception and fear around these creatures that are clearly very cool and intelligent. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, let me start this different. It's kind of a best practice you can use across lots of different topics. And we talk about a lot in science communication. I'm sure you both have heard this too. It's meeting people where they are.
Right.
If you're coming to me afraid of sharks, I'm going to meet you right there. I'm not going to try and convince you not to be terrified of sharks. I can answer whatever questions you'd like, but I'm not going to make somebody feel bad for being afraid of something. Or if somebody just has a lot of curiosity, but maybe they're coming at me with really incorrect stuff, I can meet them there too.
Yeah.
And say, yeah, you know, I can understand why you might think this, but, you know, here's some evidence for these A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And so this applies to sharks. It applies to my current role in climate change and climate adaptation. It applies, I'm sure, to microbiology. You know, there's a lot of benefit of just being completely open to accepting folks exactly where they're feeling about a topic and then having a really good conversation after that point. I think I've seen, again, a lot of my deeply respected colleagues in the shark world try and immediately go into persuasion and convincing people that sharks are these, you know, harmless things, which is not true, that, you know, are going to, I don't know, create rainbows and like all this. Like, it's just really not. And that will always work against you if your first inclination is to try and defend and persuade your study species or your study field. Starting with people exactly how they feel, understanding, asking them questions about how they got to those feelings or how they learned about some of this maybe misinformation they have is a way better place to start and then continue to a good conversation.
Right. Yeah, so starting out by telling someone is wrong is probably not the best place to start.
No.
Go figure, right? Yeah, that's excellent advice. I think, you know, for the most part, we don't really get that science communication training, whether we're microbiologists or ecologists or biochemists or, you know, physicists. I think the astronomers are usually pretty good at it.
Astronomers seem to be really good at it.
They seem to be on top of it for some reason. They're on a different level. But we don't get that kind of training. And, you know, what do you think should be done about that?
Well, I think, you know, I don't think everybody should try and force themselves to be a communications specialist. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Number one.
Yeah.
I've seen that go down in flames as well, too, mm-hmm. where you have an exceptionally brilliant scientist mm-hmm. who should just be left to be a scientist and not try to force themselves into being a communicator if that's not where their passions are.
Right.
So I'm a huge advocate of universities, departments, centers like the one I'm working at now to have dedicated communication staff who can certainly help train folks who are interested in that, but not obligate, right, mm-hmm. all researchers to then also be communications professionals. And that's something that often happens with communications, too. I think it's because we communicate every day, you know, that we think that communications is just something that you can tack on. And in some trainings, you absolutely can, but it's also important to understand that communications is its own separate social science that has a ton of literature and best practices and hard-earned, you know, best practices mm-hmm. and what works well and is constantly iterating and adapting to the environment that we find ourselves in with information flow and mm-hmm. things like that. So I don't want to discourage scientists. I want to encourage them that they don't need to be communicators, that they can rely on their communication staff or they can rely on colleagues that are interested in and educated in communications. I think, though, if you go into certain fields, you do need to be ready to answer questions. Mm-hmm. And my role now, working for a climate change center and a climate adaptation center, certainly we all understand that if you're working in that type of environment, especially nowadays, you're going to get questions and you should be ready to answer questions at the best of your ability and using some of those best practices and communications. So it's not a clean answer. I'm sorry, Shahir, but it's one that shifts constantly. And I tell folks, you know, if it feels deeply uncomfortable, you should listen to that and not try and force yourself into a situation where you could flub or, you know, mm-hmm. say something accidentally that could not present your research or yourself very well.
You actually bring up a very good point, and I think this is something that I agree with you on. I think both of us agree with you on this, that not everyone is going to be a talented communicator. Not every scientist, brilliant scientist, is going to be really good at making the information digestible for a general audience. And, you know, we really shouldn't have to force that. But there are people who have a knack for it, have a passion for it, they like it. They may not have the time or the, you know, the reward structure for it. And I'm intentional about saying the reward structure because mm-hmm. in an academic setting, typically what we're being rewarded for is things like publication, maybe training students, teaching, funding, going on conferences, all of those things, not really about engaging with the public. So that's not really a thing. So while, mm-hmm. you know, you make a very good point that, yes, not everyone should be communicating, but I also feel like a lot of the people like yourself, like ourselves, who are passionate about communication, we can maybe do a good job. We may not get the kind of institutionalized reward for it. There's right. demand for it, but there is no reward for it. So that's I think that might be a different problem altogether, too.
That's really fascinating. Yeah, demand but no reward. Yeah. I mean, and that's I field so many emails of either journalists, you know, curious about latest climate science, and you know, I only have so many people I can reach back out to. I'm like, yeah, can you answer this journalist? And they're like, God, you know, like it does become a huge amount of effort, sure. I think. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that reward structure, it gets in the way, bunny ears, right? Gets in the way of what you are getting rewarded for. So it's, the whole reward structure within academia needs a update.
We agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about your role in this climate change communications position and the kind of work you actually do? And it, you know, this is affiliated with NC State, so it seems like, at least in this capacity, there is kind of some institutional drive to make sure that this particular type of science is communicated. So I think, it's helpful for people who are curious about science, what kind of jobs you could have that aren't just researching, right? You're in this kind of different, non-traditional career. And then kind of what your day-to-day looks like and the challenges that you're facing, right? Communicating about sharks is a little bit less political divisive than climate change. So maybe what are the similarities and differences there as well?
I've been non-traditional since the day I started, and I will continue to be. Yeah, so the center is it's a federally funded center. It's based at NC State University, as you said. And being federally funded right now is very tricky. Mm-hmm. And I would say that my job has changed dramatically this year mm-hmm. as opposed to years prior. But generally, to explain the center, we work on climate adaptation, not mitigation. We're mm-hmm. just focused on here are the impacts that are occurring. Here are the impacts that will be occurring in the future. Here's the science that can help with decisions anyone might be needing to make managing those changes going into the future. And the center's footprint is from Arkansas to the Virgin Islands, which is biologically one of the most diverse areas mm-hmm. in North America, mm-hmm. culturally one of the most diverse areas in North America. And I find that fascinating. There is such an incredible challenge of just the breadth and scope of values that different communities, municipalities, states, territories have, tribes, tribal nations, and being kind of a epicenter of that knowledge is just deeply fascinating mm-hmm. to me. I love working with people, so it scratches that itch nicely for me. And because we're a solutions-based center, there's not a lot of persuasion that we have to do in our work because we're already a climate center. If you're coming to talk to us, I have not run into any sort of climate denial or anything like that, but mm-hmm. like because of our branding, right? Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that somebody would want to approach us. So that's the work. I work external communications. We produced a podcast for a while until our year changed. All sorts of external stuff, blogs, news releases, the social media end of things, and then internally communicating with researchers, our partners, state managers, federal managers, and meeting with folks, again, meeting people literally where they are, to talk about their science priorities and the issues that they're running into so that we can funnel that into a science call or a science need that then the centers can fund. So, for example, I'll be heading to Savannah next week to meet with some of our partners at Savannah State University. And a few weeks from now, I'll be headed to Miami and South Florida to be meeting with some of our partners there as well. And yeah, it's just a lot of chatting with folks, understanding what they need, and then doing our best to fill that need with other sorts of science and funding opportunities for them. You had more to your question, but I've totally forgotten it at this point.
No, I've kind of forgotten it as well, because this is super interesting. How is this type of communication different than kind of communicating about sharks in a sense, right? I can imagine there's similarities and differences.
Yeah. Maggie, honestly, it is easier to talk about climate than it is to talk about sharks. Yeah, I have personally had way more negative interactions on the shark world than I have in the climate world, for sure.
I find 100%. That very surprising, actually. Yeah. That's
100%, let me tell you. And I think that's because, you know, sharks maybe can still feel mythological and theoretical threat, whereas climate change is impacting everybody right now. It's hard to blow it out of proportion. It's hard to, give it that kind of mythology that can lead to a lot of uncertainty. People across the board where I work, people understand climate change is here. It's impacting people. They could see the impacts that are happening to their property, their businesses, their economies, and they need answers for it. So it is a kind of a different thing. I'll say that again, like we talked about before, meeting folks where they're at, that applies here too massively. We hear a lot of, I would say, extremely tragic stories about climate impacts across the Southeast. Movements of people who would much rather live where they were, but now are facing the reality that they can't anymore, and that generations after them, that they had planned to pass on their heritage and property and houses to, are no longer able to do that. And how just terrible that is for there to be this generational break with folks. We heard from business partners who have seen the impacts of drought and then extreme rain and then drought and extreme rain on crops and other livelihoods. And so I feel like with climate change, at least, we all understand that there's this shared common problem. As a center, we are very transparent with what aspects of that problem we are able to try and tackle or fund or answer, and that we can't do everything. And so there's a bit of a shared sense of community in that there is this enemy, quote unquote, of climate change, and that we are all bringing what we can to solve that problem or answer that problem for the communities and the places that we care about. So it's certainly very different from the shark world. The shark is kind of a, like I said, mythological terror, right, of the ocean that, you know, it has a lot of stories and equal parts fascination and, equal parts fear. But climate change is just this completely different animal, to continue the analogy. It's just something people are seeing every single day.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and I love the way you talk about involving members of the communities that are affected by climate change into the scientific decisions. I think scientists do, across the board, do a very poor job of what do the people actually need and want from our research and the things we're funding. Can you talk a little bit about that as well? How do those conversations go when you're trying to make this a collaborative effort between the communities and the center and the work you guys do?
Yeah, so a former director put this best. A former director of the Climate Adaptation Science Center has put this best. He said, we don't want to answer questions no one's asking. Mm. And that is the tenet of the centers. Mm-hmm. So we focus entirely on a concept of co-production, which is at the very beginning, like the pre-research proposal, we are interacting as a community of trying to understand what are the shared needs across this massive footprint that then we can prioritize and start to answer. So, for example, really dramatic example here in North Carolina, what can Western North Carolina, that was hit by Hurricane Helene last year, learn from our partners in Puerto Rico who are still recovering from Maria, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of lessons learned that we can have between these regions and answer questions people are actually asking. But if you don't know what people are asking, if you don't invest in co-production, then you'll end up with research that maybe isn't as useful and used as we'd like it to be. So we our whole purpose is to invest heavily in working groups, convenings, meetings, getting people together and talking about their needs. And to Shahir's point earlier, you know, this is part of our center. So it's the reward here is that we are fulfilling our host agreement by doing this stuff.
Right.
But that is a very unique situation to be in the academic world that doesn't always prioritize or benefit that aspect of co-production, which is, you know, driving 3 hours to have a cup of coffee with somebody to chat with them just about what they're doing and then drive 3 hours back. And in institutions like academia, they may look at that as like a wasted day, right? Like, mm-hmm. what do you have to show for that?
Sure.
So I find a sense of fulfillment and home in this center just because of that mm-hmm. huge investment towards co-production and understanding where people are so we can better meet the needs that are changing month to month, year to year with different communities across the footprint.
Do you find that people... especially maybe new groups that you're working with are hesitant to talk to you guys or is it because these climate change events have impacted them that they're willing to work? Because, you know, I find a lot of times there's an initial distrust where it's hard to even get people to be willing to communicate with you or listen to you or share what they're thinking because there's this huge barrier. I don't know, like keep saying with the institution, it's a little different than traditional academia settings. So do you find that that's the case in different populations?
Yeah, it depends. It's a really good question, Maggie. And again, it goes towards how much time are you willing to invest in trust mm-hmm. upfront? Mm-hmm. And so how often can you receive feedback or receive information and then immediately show that you're acting on that feedback and information so that people start to understand that interacting with us scientists or as the center is not a waste of their time, right? Mm-hmm. That they can see some actionable element after those interactions every single time. And again, very unique from the academic and university mm-hmm. spheres. So with that investment still, sure, there can be groups, especially with the politics of the moment, who maybe are a little bit more hesitant interacting with a center that has climate adaptation right in the name of it. However, we still have these problems, regardless of the politics. The impacts are still here. They're still happening every day. Mm-hmm. And so our center in particular, we are willing to use the language people feel more comfortable about. Mm-hmm. An example of this is, you know, partner who... doesn't believe necessarily that humans are causing climate change, does believe climate change is happening, and mm-hmm. does see the impact of climate change on their livelihoods of fishing, mm-hmm. but they don't want to talk about the human causes of that. Mm-hmm. To meet people where they're at, I'm not going to try and argue that with them. Mm-hmm. I am going to sit down and say, okay, well, tell me what you're seeing about the fish right now. Like, mm-hmm. what are the impacts that you'd want to know more about? Like, what's a study that could really help you make decisions about the future of this industry, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to spend any time at all trying to convince this person that the overwhelming amount of evidence that this is anthropologically driven, but I will use their language and I will start exactly where they're at and work towards solutions with those folks.
So how would you measure how effective these science communication and outreach efforts are within the center, but also you do a lot of other science communication as well. And you can maybe get on Shark Week or do a podcast and communicate science. How do you evaluate if you're being effective in maybe the goal isn't to change people's minds necessarily, but whatever that goal is, you know, sometimes I feel like you're just speaking to an empty room and nothing's actually changing.
Yeah.
What is that like for you?
And, you know, Maggie, oftentimes you are. Like, you're going to speak to an empty room for a long time before it starts to hit. And I think that's part of it, right? Mm-hmm. Science communication is an endurance test, right? It is. And it takes a long time to get that momentum and trust rolling with folks that you hope to reach and hope to have impact with. So that's one. Be prepared for the endurance. It can get tiring after a while. I'm seeing lots of nodding heads. So there's that aspect of it. When it comes to how we measure, you know, there are two things that I often look for. One is, will people keep coming back to us to ask questions or refer people to us because we were useful for this and they've heard this person's having a problem, so they send them our way. That's a huge yes, that we are really doing our job. If word of mouth is, these people are useful, take your problem to them, that's the best win. Another maybe non-traditional way that I like to look at whether or not we're doing a good job too is if people will come to us and tell us we did a bad job. So if they're willing to come to us and say, hey, you started off with a good idea with this, but this doesn't work. Or, hey, your language in this, like, we actually don't want to use that language. Like, we'd rather fix it. That, too, for me, is a momentous opportunity to build trust with folks and say, 100%, you got it. Like, we can change this. We can, you know, we can fix this issue. Because ultimately what they're communicating is, I like our relationship and I want to continue to have this research relationship. So I'm going to correct these problems with you versus, you know, look at you doing this dumb thing and never working with you again and you'll never hear from me again. Those are primarily the two measures that we like to look for. And I think we're doing a better job every week with seeing that start to ding up. But it took many years of seemingly talking to the void before it starts to strife.
So it's a mixture of the positive feedback and the negative feedback, and both are very constructive.
It's and all connection.
And informative.
Well,
this is really fantastic, and the work that you do is really fascinating. It's very important, and I think hopefully our lovely listeners, I'm sure our lovely listeners, appreciate that work. And I just want to ask a quick question, because you've given so much advice to young people, but if you know, basically, if there's a young person, a young scientist or a science communicator that's starting, what would be kind of the culmination of your advice? So what would be your advice to them?
Oh my God, just a really easy question, Shahir. You know, I think it goes back to what we were talking about at the top. Especially if you're still in graduate school or undergrad, but this applies, I think, at every stage. There are opportunities out there, even right now, even in this job market. There are opportunities out there to try new things. The more things you try, to go back to positive and negative feedback, the more you will start to understand better what you are passionate about. So, yeah, I've had this, you know, I can point all the way back to all the dots that made sense. I had a lot of stinkers along the way, too, things that I did that I did not like and said, I will never do that again. And you need those experiences as well while you're trying to figure out what your path is going to look like. So while you can, take advantage of opportunities, say yes to stuff. Even if it turns out to not be your jam, you're learning a lot about yourself, and that's really important. So go for it. Science communication in particular, there are many science communication careers that are not called science communication at all in their job title. So especially folks who are in the job hunt, be really critical and don't exclude too many search terms. A lot of program managers are actually science communication roles. A lot of lab manager positions are actually science communication roles. So keep your search broad because, and this is of no fault to the labs or people, universities just don't have that job title. So they call it something else. So keep that in mind. But yeah, the more experiences you can rack up and the more reps you have of doing interviews like this, talking to classrooms, you know, getting out there and honing your messaging, the better and the easier and less intimidating things like this will feel into the future as well. So just get out there and do the thing. It's not great advice, I feel like.
No, that's excellent advice. I think
you just got to do it.
Yeah, I think just working with students this semester, they're so afraid to make the wrong decision, even right. like on learning about how to make a hypothesis. And it's they're so afraid that that's the wrong hypothesis. I'm like, that's the whole point, right? They're really paralyzed with that. And so I think hearing, yeah, you can try something and it doesn't have to work out, or maybe you fail at it, right? You could even totally bomb and you still learn something and can make those pivots. This is not, you know, the one wrong decision is not the end of your path and whatever right. you do. And I think it's helpful to hear that from people who have gone through it and now like have a job that they love and are probably going to try something else in the future as well. I can imagine you'll something else will pop up for you that you can say yes to. So I think yeah, it's excellent advice.
We filled this one podcast with how things worked out. I think if we did it again, talking about what didn't work out, that would be like three podcasts.
three hours worth of
probably.
Well, that's absolutely true. I'll tell my students, the only way that you can find out that you don't like apple pie is by trying apple pie or whatever food. It could be anything. And so you just have to try some things.
Yeah. So. Okay. I have two last shark questions I want to end on that are kind of like hopefully a little bit more rapid fire. But also, if you want to elaborate, please do. Because, you know, I feel like we didn't get enough shark information.
Never enough shark information.
Okay, so what is the most surprising thing you've learned about sharks through your research in your career so far?
I think it was a realization. And so let me talk you through this.
Yes.
Because it has to do with how incredible large, mature female white sharks are. So they are going to be like 4.5 meters in length by the time that they're sexually mature, that they can start to produce pups. And what's important to remember here, white sharks give live birth. They don't lay eggs. Mm-hmm. They're very mammalian in a way. Mm-hmm. A female white shark will give birth to between, let's call it 8 and 12, let's meet it in the middle, 10 white shark pups at a time. Each white shark pup is 5 feet long at birth.
Oh my gosh.
To account for this, female white sharks have twin uteri that run mm-hmm. down the length of their bodies. And you can imagine just like a sardine stack of 5 and 5.
Wow.
5 foot white sharks. I'm throwing a lot of fives at you.
Yeah.
You know, aligning their body, which is why they have to be so big before they can be sexually mature, right? Mm-hmm. So they are just, and they're just swimming around hunting stuff.
while they're carrying, you know, 10,
50 feet of white sharks inside of them.
Oh my gosh.
And hunting and being this incredible predator. So yeah, I've just found really large female white sharks fascinating. Their anatomy is fascinating. And I can't imagine, like, you're going to be that hugely pregnant and then hunt down seals at the same time. Like, it's just the power.
Yeah, I was pregnant with one at a time, and I was like, I'm not doing anything, especially when you're, like, that pregnant.
You weren't hunting seals?
I was not hunting seals.
You weren't chasing down anything to, like, yeah.
No, just eating ice cream on the couch. That is quite impressive. I did not know that. And maybe that what you just shared is an answer to this last question as well. But what is your favorite shark fact that never fails to get a reaction?
This is another one I love when I take people shark diving because they don't believe me as if I'm lying. But anyway, white sharks, again, from Jaws, we've heard Quint say that they've got black soulless eyes of a doll, you know, that line. They actually have bright blue husky eyes.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Their irises are absolutely gorgeous. And I will tell people that before a dive and they're just kind of like, no way. And I'm like, why would I? I'm not making this up. But then, yeah, once they get in the water and they see it, they're like, wow, like these animals. And there's something, too, about that that I think makes them connect in a different way, that they have kind of similar looking eyes to us. And like I said before, you can actually watch them, you know, look around and make eye contact with things in the water. It's just wonderful. So I love sharing that with people, mostly because they totally don't believe me until they Google it. And then they're like, oh, yeah, the shark scientist was not lying to me. Like, why?
There's way cooler things you could lie about.
Yeah.
I have one question that's always kind of been in the back of my mind about sharks, and it's specific to the hammerhead sharks.
Oh,
yeah.
When I first saw hammerhead sharks on TV as a child, I didn't think they were real. I was like, what is this? This is ridiculous. What is happening here? Do you know anything about why they have this kind of anatomy? Does it give them any kind of advantage? It seems like it's just going to get stuck somewhere.
Well, and let me say, I'm not a hammerhead scientist, so this is my apology to my hammerhead scientist friends who will have way more robust knowledge about this. But here's what I know. They have, and again, just as from an evolutionary perspective, like how crazy of a shape.
Yeah.
Right? If you think of evolution as just tinkering with what you got, like that is a nuts shape to come up with.
It's so weird.
That works so well. So one of the reasons they have that broad front, again, to go back to our pub quiz, the Ampullae of Lorenzini that they have there, it spreads it out. So instead of a white shark being a singular point of focus of that electric sense, hammerheads now have more of like a metal detector, right? Yeah. Like, spread out sense of electric senses. Yeah. That's because most of their prey are rays or other animals that are buried in the sand.
Ah,
so they're actually sweeping around like a metal detector, trying to find these pieces of prey. Now, what's even cooler about their shape is, once they're chasing something, and I've seen a hammerhead chase some prey before, and it's shocking, they're able to turn like 180 on a dime with that shape, because it's almost like a hydrofoil cutting through the water. So they're able to do these extremely fast and severe turns because they just have less drag, right? Yeah,
it's like a blade cutting through water.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly like a blade.
Yeah.
So it's... You look at this thing, like you said, Shahir, it's like, what? How is this even? But when you think about the prey that they're going for and the way that they hunt them, which is entirely chase, right? That's the best shape for that job.
And the eyes, correct me if I'm wrong, the eyes are actually popping out of the hammer ends.
Yeah, right? So they're way out.
Way out there. Oh, my.
Yeah.
What a strange creature. I love it.
It unlocked a memory of when I was a kid. I had a brief interest in marine biology when I was probably like in fourth grade, and I would just draw pictures of sharks and hang them on my wall. And the hammerhead was obviously my favorite one.
Yeah.
And I was always excited to see them at the aquariums and stuff, because it is one of the more bizarre looking creatures.
So bizarre.
And seems to make no sense. But that is evolution, baby. That is why it's so cool. And these things don't just exist in isolation. The evolution behind it is with other species and where they are. It's all so intertwined and complicated. And that's why I love science. I love it all. And it's all, you know.
And now that you mentioned this kind of sweeping motion, when I think back to the videos of hammerhead sharks that I see, they're kind of zigzagging over the sand. And their tail is kind of wagging back and forth as their head swings from left to right.
Yep.
It's like a minesweeper.
Mm.
Exactly right. And I'll tell you one last very cool thing because about hammerheads, why not? Very recently, and I'm talking in the last decade, different companies have specialized in putting animal-borne cameras onto sharks. So there's a way that you can... Essentially, if you think of their fin slicing through the water, you can kind of put a clamp on their fin and then point a camera so you get their POV. And what researchers found when they did this with hammerheads is that they don't swim flat.
They don't, like, not straight the whole way. Yeah.
They swim at an angle always.
Oh.
And so, one, they found that it just makes better sense with drag for them to be at an angle versus swimming like perpendicular to the floor.
To the floor. Yeah.
And also it extends that sweep of their ampullae of Lorenzini. It gets them a greater angle so that they're actually picking up more than just what's directly underneath.
Right,
so
that's a wider field.
A wider field of detection. They only figured that out after putting these cameras on them because they actually thought at the beginning that they put their cameras on all wrong because they kept coming back at this angle. But yeah, it's actually, again, this crazy evolutionary driver of their behavior to make them swim kind of sideways.
Also, I got to say, you said something that is very science thing to do, which is the first thing that the researchers thought about is that they screwed up. They put the camera wrong because we always think like, this can't be. I must have messed up. Like, and I think this is kind of a misconception and that we're always right and the results are going to show. The first thing that you always doubt is your ability to do the experiment, no matter what level you're in.
Yep. I must have messed something up. That's why this, especially when it's something kind of cool and
And groundbreaking.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is so cool.
Yeah. I think this is just a wonderful way to end the podcast talking about hammerheads and everything. I'm so grateful that you made time to chat with us for the past hour. This has been so fun, and I'm really grateful for the work that you're doing to serve all these populations affected by climate change and also talk about cool stuff like sharks. So thank you so much, and always happy to talk to a fellow Rust Belter as well.
Yes, and especially someone who lives in North Carolina. So we'll have to meet up when we're down there at some point. For sure.
I would love that. Let's go get some bagels. Let's go get some barbecue.
Perfect. Okay. Bagels and barbecue.
That's great.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Seriously, thank you. Really appreciate the invitation.
Of course, anytime. All right. Bye, Shahir.
Bye. Thank you. At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listener, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. A special thanks to the wonderful people at the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences and the IU South Bend Library. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is the Rust Belt Science. I am Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time. Bye.